This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, September 14th, 2021 on KUAF, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. Today, an aspect of legalized medical marijuana in Arkansas, security. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich introduces us to the people who keep a watch on the stash of medical marijuana. Many of them are vets. And later, a textbook that, with some modifications, was used to teach mathematics for nearly 2,000 years, Euclid, rare books, and an upcoming honors college course at the University of Arkansas in our second half hour. Most of the numbers in yesterday's COVID-19 report from the Arkansas Department of Health are what's become normal for reports based on Sundays, smaller. There are just fewer than 650 new cases in the most recent report and 2,652 doses of vaccine administered on Sunday. Deaths from the virus in Arkansas, unfortunately, remained relatively high, with 31 newly reported fatal cases in the 24-hour period. There have now been 374 virus deaths counted by the ADH since the start of September. Hospitalizations from the virus in patients requiring ventilators both dropped slightly by 5 and 1, respectively. The number of virus patients in hospitals in Washington and Benton counties is dropping. Northwest Arkansas healthcare providers count 94 patients today. That's 26 fewer than this time Friday. Still, though, hospitals in the two counties are using more than 100 ICU beds and have been for 2 months now. About 91% of people hospitalized in Northwest Arkansas with COVID-19 have not been vaccinated. Governor Asa Hutchinson is scheduled to address the state's approach to the virus this afternoon at 1:30. While some Arkansans are still reluctant to get a COVID-19 vaccine, others are eagerly awaiting their booster shot of either Pfizer or Moderna. Dr. Jennifer Dillahay, Director for Immunizations for the Arkansas Department of Health, says only immunocompromised people who have been contacted by their doctor or clinic should get a third dose.
There are people out there going in and getting booster doses, and they shouldn't be. They think they're supposed to because of all the confusing communication about it out there. But we're encouraging people not to try to get a booster dose. The vaccinators aren't supposed to be giving them.
The Federal Food and Drug Administration is expected to make a recommendation on Pfizer booster shots later this month. Dr. Dillahay says the recommendation will likely include information about optimal dosage and timing to provide the greatest protection against the virus. Arkansas Children's Research Institute and the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences are receiving more than $11 million in renewed funding from the National Institutes of Health for continued study of childhood obesity prevention. The funding will be directed toward the Center for Childhood Obesity Prevention at Children's in Little Rock, which was established in 2016. The center's mission is to initiate research supporting basic, clinical, and infrastructure improvements. Walmart says it was the victim of a false press release yesterday issued by a group called Globe Newswire. The bogus release purported that the Bentonville retailer had engaged in a partnership with Litecoin, a cryptocurrency. Walmart says it has no relationship with that company. The annual Chili Pepper cross-country races in Fayetteville will now be spread over 2 days in 2021. The University of Arkansas Athletic Department announced yesterday the collegiate races will be held Friday evening, October 1st, the women's race starting at 5, the men beginning at 5:30. The high school races will still be held on Saturday morning, October 2nd, at the Agri Park course. The announcement indicates there will be spectators allowed at the Friday evening collegiate competition. More information available at chilipepperfestival.org. And the final homestand of the Northwest Arkansas natural season begins tonight at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale. The Nats host Springfield tonight through Sunday afternoon. This is Ozarks at Large. Several specialized security firms protect Arkansas's growing medical marijuana industry. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the top-ranked Liberty Defense Group, based in Northwest Arkansas, also specializes in providing employment to Arkansas veterans.
John Reeves and Ryan Hansen are co-founders of Liberty Defense Group. Reeves asked that we not disclose the location of company headquarters nor medical marijuana facilities they are under contract to protect.
We just kind of saw a need in the cannabis space that needed security, and there was really no one at the time that was even interested to provide these guys protection.
Reeves and Hansen traveled to Colorado in 2016, one of the first states to legalize medical marijuana, to observe how security forces operate there. They deployed a Liberty Defense Group a year later, one of only a few specialized security firms in Arkansas.
So we started out with myself as the first employee, providing that security for our first client a few years back. And then now we're roughly around that 80 to 90 employees over three states.
Currently, Liberty Defense Group provides security to 24 medical marijuana facilities in Arkansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma.
We come in, we have our guy that's there. He's usually in that reception area. He's making those rounds around that facility. He's watching cameras, the CCTV cameras. So he's working with the client and the staff there at that facility, that manager, to make sure that anything security, safety-wise, is really controlled.
Medical marijuana dispensaries, which number 36 in Arkansas, are where state-registered patients legally purchase remedies to smoke or ingest. To enter, patients must show personal ID as well as a medical marijuana registry identification card to security personnel standing guard at entrances.
So we, in the dispensary world, we really try to bring that customer service to the patients and to let them know that, we're not there to protect the entity or that dispensary from them, right? We're really there to provide them that service that, hey, you bring in this amount of cash and you're going out with equal or bigger value of a Schedule I narcotic product, then we want to make sure you're protected. And at least we can do is protect you in that parking lot, getting to your car, making sure that there's nothing going on around that area.
Reeves business partner Ryan Hansen is company CFO.
All the dispensaries that we're in after hours are closed down, locked down. Our guards are not there. Once personnel leaves, for the most part, there's no guards there. Now, there's cultivations that do have 24-hour security because clearly there's people that work there 24 hours a day in a cultivation. But for the most part, clearly we want to protect the product and the money, but our most important thing that we protect are the people.
Reeves served in the U.S. Marine Corps on combat tours in Afghanistan and Iraq as a motorman and machine gunner, as well as providing armed security. Ryan Hansen also served in the Marine Corps as a combat veteran.
5 years active duty. I guarded embassies around the world my last 3 years in the Marine Corps. When I got out of there, I was recruited by a company called Blackwater, and I did all U.S. diplomats' security in country of Iraq and Afghanistan from 05 to 08. So I was with Blackwater for 3-plus years after the Marine Corps.
Reeves and Hansen, both Arkansas natives, met while working in the oil frack fields after military service, later joining forces to establish Liberty Defense Group. 90% of company employees are veterans, and they come fully enabled, Reeves says, to fulfill this job, along with medical marijuana industry protection. Liberty Defense Group, which can be found on Facebook, also provides executive cash transportation and construction site security protection, active shooter response training, and armed vehicle personnel transports.
The big reason that we hire veterans is not only because we were and we wanted to give them a softer place to land, something that's kind of paramilitary, but also the U.S. military puts this training in us for years and years and years to be observant, to de-escalate stuff, to act appropriately, not to be, too aggressive, not to be too assertive, but to read people, to be observant, and to do our jobs without having to do our jobs. So that is Liberty's mission statement. And again, John and I both came back from, we've got 7 tours between the two of us. And we both came back kind of lost, like a lot of veterans do. You're in combat with 50 or 60 of the closest people you've ever been to. And then within 2 weeks, you're all over the United States and you feel really lost and alone. And John and I felt very compelled to help people, give people help that we didn't get.
Hansen says Liberty Defense Group operates under a command structure, holding staff accountable. Most are paid hourly. All employees undergo criminal background checks and drug screenings. Liberty Defense provides unique training to ensure protection of dispensary patients, dispensary and cultivation site workers, and the medical marijuana inventory. Marijuana remains listed as a Schedule I drug under the Federal Controlled Substances Act, although most states have enacted laws and policies to allow for either medical or recreational cultivation, sale, distribution, and possession. John Reeves says Arkansas's medical marijuana inventory is well secured under state regulations.
Every facility here in the state has to actually, they have a set time limit, right? So when that store closes, that product has to go into a safe, a vault, right? So that product is, if you even try to break into one of these facilities, not only are you up against their secured building, whatever they put into their building to make it secure on the outside, but you also have alarm systems. Those alarm systems are monitored 24/7.
A half dozen cultivation facilities in Arkansas that grow tons of raw plant material are vulnerable sites, he says.
Cultivators have guard services, kind of the same way. It's a little bit different in the cultivation world because there's no patients, right? So really what our guards are doing are making sure that there's no one coming on property, making sure there's no theft, no break-ins, because you're talking about, you know, a cultivator, they spend millions upon millions of dollars building their facility, let alone the amount of millions of dollars in their facility.
Reese says there's not been organized or gang-generated incursions at any facilities in Arkansas to date, but just in case, Hansen says their security teams collaborate with local and county law enforcement.
And if we have a call or we need to call them, they know who we are. They're not just responding to somebody they don't know.
Arkansas medical marijuana industry security firms are regulated by the Arkansas State Police. Scott Harden is spokesperson for the Arkansas Medical Marijuana Commission, which also provides certain oversight.
What happens is before anyone goes to work in a dispensary or a cultivation facility, and that's whether you're a bud tender or you're working security, before you walk into that facility on the first day, you have to have what's known as a registry ID card.
Which can only be obtained by those with no criminal record, Harden says. More than 1,100 medical marijuana industry workers, including security, have special registry ID cards.
Most of these companies, the cultivators and the dispensaries, most of them don't have people on staff or don't want to hire someone directly to work security. And so what we're seeing is most of them, the majority, outsource this. And many of them, Liberty is one of the more popular companies that's being utilized.
Because, Harden says, combat veterans have a unique skill set to fulfill the complex and potentially dangerous job requirement.
And thankfully, to date, if you look at it, these facilities have remained totally safe. And I would argue that these cultivators and dispensaries are among the most secure places in the state.
Including biometric entries, camera surveillance, and alarm systems.
The first dispensary opened back in May of 2019, and since that time, there has not been one incident of someone walking into a dispensary and trying to hold it up or steal anything and then walk out with it.
Nearly 80,000 patients are registered with the Arkansas Department of Health to legally obtain medical marijuana. To date, they've spent more than $400
million. $400
million
flowing through really what's now 36 companies across the state. That is a lot of money through a small number of companies and just highlights the need for strong security.
Scott Harden says medical marijuana patient registrations in Arkansas soared last year, far beyond industry expectations. Still, Arkansas is one of the more restrictive medical marijuana states in the union. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Residents in Pea Ridge and Garfield have until 7:30 tonight to cast votes in special elections. Voters in Pea Ridge determining whether to issue bonds for street work and improvements and whether there should be a new 1% sales tax to repay the bond and provide more capital for the city. In Garfield, today voters are deciding if a half-cent sales tax for water system improvements should be permanent. A new report from in-market researchers indicates Bentonville-based Walmart has the highest level of loyalty among shoppers in the American retail sector. Talk Business and Politics reports Walmart had the highest mark, 3.22, which is well above the national average of 1.33. Fred Meyer, owned by Kroger, placed second in that report. That report also says Walmart did a better job than most in getting inventory on shelves, including fast-moving consumables that are in short supply because of supply chain challenges. Ahead on our show, why Arkansas's Secretary of State will not require the more than 100 employees in that office to become vaccinated or submit to weekly tests. Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore reached out to Secretary of State John Thurston yesterday.
I'm Scott Tong. Have you looked at the fine print of your house's deed? Well, some of them have what's called a racial covenant.
It declared that no one outside of European descent or outside of the white race could buy, rent, or occupy the land.
Removing racial covenants, that's next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now, this afternoon at 1 on KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. Arkansas Secretary of State John Thurston released a statement yesterday announcing his office would not be requiring employees to receive the COVID-19 vaccine, nor would they be requiring proof of a negative test. This is in response to President Joe Biden, who recently announced a vaccine mandate for all employers who have at least 100 employees. That includes the Secretary of State's office. Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore reached out to the secretary and asked if he knew how many of his employees are currently vaccinated.
I sure don't. I have never asked and won't. I will not ask. I mean, I feel that it's individuals' medical records or decisions are personal, so I've never asked those questions to staff.
The other element of this, too, is you say that nor will I require proof of negative COVID tests. I think from my point of view, I can understand not wanting to require vaccines, but I think requiring negative tests is just a matter of safety more than a matter of freedoms. Sure. Would you argue with that?
And you know, no, and perhaps that could have been worded a little differently because I think, you know, I believe it was Biden had said, you know, you're either going to have to be vaccinated or you're going to have to prove negative weekly or every 3 days, or I don't know the exact number. We are not going to do that. We're not going to require an individual to come weekly with a negative COVID test. And that's kind of when we stated that was the reason. And of course, even if someone is tested positive, we have not, of course, they're quarantined. They're off work for the number of days that CDC recommends. Even then, you don't go and get another test to make sure you are COVID-free. Before you come back, you do not have to do that once you've been quarantined. The number of days and plus, you know, not had any symptoms and fever and so forth, whatever is involved in that.
I wonder if an argument could be made, though, that your health decisions are such a personal freedom that one could argue that even if they do test positive, that they should still be able to come to work. What would you say if you had an employee who made that argument?
Well, that's a good point. I mean, and I don't know that you could tell them not to come to work constitutionally.
Would that concern you and your fellow staff members if you had an employee who made that decision?
Well, I think we would have to address that if it came up. I suppose an option would be that they would be working alone somewhere away from everyone. That's for sure. I don't know. Has that come up that someone – have you ever heard of that?
I haven't. I haven't.
Yeah, I mean,
no, but I can
– I haven't either.
But I can imagine that
it's possible. It's
sure.
Possible. Sure.
I imagine that there are certain libertarians who would – push the envelope as far as they could, perhaps. I don't know that that's a reality, but it worries me that, you know, if we have folks who are so adamant about not getting a vaccine and so adamant about not getting tested, that it's in the realm of possibility that someone could test positive and say, well, it's a false negative, or they could say, I'm not that concerned. I'm young. I'm
sure.
I'm healthy.
Sure.
So I think that's where my concern comes from.
Sure. And, you know, and I suppose that, you know, we'd have to see if it passes a constitutional test. I mean, that's really my position. It's not so much from a position of pro or anti-vaccine or anything like that. It's a position of individual liberties and, you know, you own your own health. You make your own health decisions without any incentives or any arm twisting from your employer or even the government.
I understand your point of view. I think, though, that viewing an incentive as a dirty word or as a bad thing is a little misaligned, though, because I think for some folks, it may take an incentive to make the right choice, even if it's not the choice that they would naturally make.
Well, that's a good point, but what is the right choice?
Sure. I think when we look at tax incentives, right, there are companies who can choose to set up shop in Florida, or they can choose to set up shop in Arkansas, or they can choose to set up shop in Texas. Right. And there are incentives for folks to make that decision. And I would argue that incentives aren't a bad thing in that way. So I wonder why you would be opposed to incentives on the personal level.
Well, that's a valid point. I guess it leads one to think that it has more to do with getting a person to make a particular decision than it does with, I'm concerned about your health.
Secretary, have you had an opportunity to get the vaccine yet?
You know, I'm going to keep my medical records and decisions confidential.
That was Arkansas Secretary of State John Thurston with Ozarks at Large's Matthew Moore. More thoughts about the president's executive action ahead when John Brummett, a political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, offers his thoughts about that order to Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics. That's about 1 minute away. One topic they covered in their conversation this week that we don't have time for on our show, but you can hear at talkbusiness.net, is this weekend's Razorback football victory over Texas. At the end of that game, fans rushed and filled the field at Reynolds Razorback Stadium, a move that goes against SEC protocol and will cost the U of A Athletic Department $100,000. The fine is the second against Arkansas levied by the conference for fans rushing the football field. The first time was in 2014. Levels of the penalties rise with each infraction. The SEC says it earmarks such money toward the SEC Postgraduate Scholarship Fund. You need no money to follow all the news from KUAF and NPR anywhere, anytime, by using our free, updated KUAF app. You can stream all of our signals, including the round-the-clock classical music on KUAF 2 and jazz on KUAF 3. You can find recent full episodes of Ozarks at Large, and you can even leave us a comment with your voice by using the all-new Connect button. The KUAF app is free and can be found in the App Store.
The Hillberry Harvest Moon Music and Camping Festival is October 7th through the 10th at The Farm in Eureka Springs, and KUAF is giving you the chance to win tickets. Hillberry welcomes Railroad Earth, Arkansas, Opal Agafia, and more. Registration and additional information available at KUAF.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. A busy past few days have the attention of John Brummett, a political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock with our partner, Talk Business and Politics. This past weekend's observations of the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks included a speech from former President George W. Bush that addressed terrorism, foreign and domestic. Roby asked John Brummett what he thought about that speech that covered both the terrorism of 20 years ago and the politics of 2021.
I will say this, and I think I'm assuming he did not write those remarks, but I'm going to say that he had the good sense to retain a lyrical, beautiful, thoughtful speechwriter and deliver the remarks as well as he could. He's not a compelling speaker. But you're referring to his general appropriate remarks about that day, but also I assume that he said those terrorists and the ones we see now domestically, they're like cousins. They're like of the same culture, and we must resist and fight both with equal vigor. And people have taken that to mean, as I think it's fair to say, that George W. was saying, you clowns who listen to Trump and invaded the U.S. Capitol trying to stop our democracy, talking about you. Without saying so, it's pretty clear he was talking about them. And some point later, he made some reference to modern politics. Oh, yeah, really profound point. And you remember this. Many of us who really didn't think much of George W., after 9/11, we rallied around him. He was our only president. He was our president. And we really, the nation came together. And he came out at that baseball game, the Yankees game, with a bulletproof vest and fired a near strike, sort of in defiance. This is America. You can't beat us. And there was great support. The nation came together to the point that the Republicans carried the midterms because which is very rare for the incumbent controlling party of the White House to carry the midterms because there's some sort of midterm reaction. And he said, that's the America I know. The America I'm seeing now, where every disagreement is a culture war, is not the America I know. And it was an excellent, he didn't deliver it beautifully, but it was a beautifully written speech. George W. is kind of reformed, kind of rehabilitated by the passage of time, by the fact that he has kept a low profile, and by the fact that he was succeeded by a Republican president, not immediately, but eventually, who furthered this nutty resentment politics, which has made George W. seem all the more moderate, made us almost, some of us almost long for him, even though Afghanistan and Iraq and torture, those were his and Cheney's deals. Nonetheless, kudos to him. It was a thoughtful, appropriate, and significant address that he gave.
Yeah. Let's turn our attention to the current president. And late last week, he is imposing a vaccine mandate, although there is an outlet clause for those that don't want it. It does specify that I believe employers with more than 100 employees, federal employees, contractors with the federal government, and healthcare professionals all must receive a vaccine to basically keep their job and keep their contracts. What's your response to that vaccine mandate? And then we'll get into the politics of it. What's your immediate response? Is that the right thing to do? Did Biden make the right move?
I believe that he did. I think this is a time for strong leadership. And I think Biden actually, notwithstanding the incredible mess made and tragedies occurring in Afghanistan, that was a strong presidential move. We're getting out. We're pulling the plug. We're coming back. Didn't go well, but decisiveness. And now this, he's saying, this is important, folks. This, you Republican governors are letting us down with by resisting mess. And I'm going to, he's testing the powers of the presidency. The Supreme Court ruled in the smallpox era that that state governments and local governments can impose mandates for vaccines. They did in the interest of the public health. He is going, so I think a lot of what he's doing has some grounding in precedent. And I think, of course, he can take charge of federal employees and he can use the power of the purse to say those who receive Medicare and Medicaid must require vaccines. He's going one step further by saying employers with more than 100 employees, we're going to make you require vaccines by using the Workplace Safety Agency, OSHA. And we're going to say that's a workplace safety issue. That's going to be litigated. It may be over the line. Who knows with the kinds of courts that we have, and that'll be argued legally, I'm sure. But he is saying somebody's got to do something because this thing's out of control, and we could reduce this. We could beat this if only we had the gumption, and it's up to the president to show the gumption. I think it's the right thing to do.
John Brummett is a political columnist, and his work can be found in the Arkansas Democrat Gazette and online at ArkansasOnline.com. He spoke with Roby Brock from our partner Talk Business and Politics. More can be seen and heard from their conversation each week at talkbusiness.net. The Oklahoma Department of Health says it counted just more than 1,000 new cases of COVID-19 in today's report and 44 newly reported deaths from the virus in the last 24 hours. Since Friday, there have been 104 fatal cases of COVID-19 reported in Oklahoma. A few months ago, we had a conversation here about a survey conducted about the arts and artists in Northwest Arkansas. That survey created by Creative Arkansas Community Hub and Exchange, or CASH. The results are now known, and there are three big need takeaways. One, an active, engaged, and accessible arts marketplace in Northwest Arkansas. Two, scaffolded and accessible career pathways for artists. And three, help with audience development. The results were released mid-morning today. We're going to read them thoroughly and then explore them more on an upcoming edition of Ozarks at Large.
Millions of people across the U.S. lack access to reliable high-speed internet, like the people living on one reservation in rural Nevada.
School started an hour and 5 minutes ago, and we do not have internet. We don't have a way to take attendance to ensure that students are in the right classes at the right moment.
Why so much of the country doesn't have reliable internet? This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, this afternoon from 3 to 6 on KUAF and at KUAF.com. This month, Arkansas State Police are deploying a fleet of 24 discreetly marked black Chevy Tahoes across the state to apprehend aggressive and distracted drivers. The new fleet is in addition to traditional white state police patrol sedans that feature the classic blue stripes and ID decals. Aggressive drivers are defined as those that speed, weave through traffic, tailgate, or threaten other drivers. Bill Sadler, Arkansas State Police Public Information Officer, says so far this year, troopers have issued more than 52,000 aggressive driving violations. Of those, 2,400 were for speeding well in excess of 100 miles per hour, a 100% increase since 2019.
This is a phenomenon that we've never experienced in Arkansas. However, in talking with other state police agencies around the country, it is very common, and it began to show up on the state highways around the country about the time that the COVID virus began to run rampant across the country.
We also reached out to the Arkansas Department of Transportation Highway Police. They have authority over commercial traffic in Arkansas. Captain Glenn Holloway says their force is also dealing with unusually high numbers of excessive speeding violators, which include certain tractor trailers clocked at over 90 miles per hour. New data provided by National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration for this report shows a 10% increase in motor vehicle traffic deaths so far this year compared to last year. The NHTSA also says driving patterns have changed significantly from previous years, citing much more risky behavior. Bill Sadler with the Arkansas State Police says the new low-profile patrols will also target distracted drivers, including those texting or watching movies in vehicles on digital devices. Those patrols will also be watching for drivers cruising in multi-lane highway left passing lanes. This because of a new law recently amended by the Arkansas State Legislature.
Prior to this most recent change, the law had stipulated that signage must be posted by the Arkansas Department of Transportation telling drivers in particular sections of roadways to use the middle or the far right lane and to only use the left lane for passing purposes. That language has been stricken. And the statute was reworked to making it very clear that the only purpose for the left lane is to actively pass, just to set the cruise control and proceed down the left lane is now prohibited in Arkansas.
The new low-profile Arkansas State Police Patrol vehicles, fully equipped with law enforcement technology, were purchased with federal grant money totaling $1.15 million, provided by the National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration.
Support for KUAF comes from Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, makers of simple breakfast cereals, including high-fiber, Old Country-style muesli, made with whole grains, nuts, seeds, and fruit, online at bobsredmill.com. and available at Walmart. The Center for Arkansas Farms and Food offers educational classes and apprenticeships for small specialty crop farming. CAFF is training the next generation of Arkansas farmers to provide locally grown food. CAFF is part of the University of Arkansas System Division of Agriculture. Application deadline is October 1st. uafarmschool.org for more information.
This is Ozarks at Large. For about 2,000 years, maybe more, what humans knew of geometry was shared through a book compiled by Euclid. We really don't know much about the person, Euclid, but we do know the principles and rules he collected were used to teach students for a couple of millennia into the early 20th century. And next semester, students in the University of Arkansas Honors College will be able to watch the evolution of Euclid's legacy and the 20th century move away from some of the principles he compiled in a signature seminar that will be co-taught by Edmund Harris, an assistant professor in the math department at the University of Arkansas, and Joshua Youngblood, the head of instruction and outreach in special collections in the University of Arkansas Library Rare Books Collection. I talked with both of them recently by Zoom and asked them about the legacy of Euclid's book, both in the terms of mathematics and in the terms of general education. We hear from Joshua Youngblood, the rare books expert, first.
I'll let Edmund speak to the importance to the discipline of mathematics, but just as a book. And that's one of the fascinating things about the conversations we've had for years now about Euclid's Elements, but also just math texts and textbooks and books in general, is the transmission of knowledge and how does that knowledge evolve? How does the text evolve? And then how does that relate to books and texts as objects themselves? And so Euclid's Elements is the most successful textbook in history, and maybe even the first textbook. And it's also was in circulation, if you want to call it that, for years and years and years. And it was handed down. It traveled geographic locations, through languages, through religions, through different mythological worldviews, through all of those things to make it all the way to the 19th and into the 20th century and 21st century now with me and Dr. Harris giving our class. But, you know, as a book, it's one of the most widely read books. One of the things that our class and our ongoing discussions will look at is the importance of the book during the book transitional periods or early modern periods. So how does this thing that was passed down through papyri to manuscript folio, written down on vellum, passed from monastic understanding to monastic understanding, become a print object, and then a really, really important print object, which then influences not only mathematics, but then what is print book? What is the meaning of the book? How are books used?
It was a summation of the mathematical knowledge of a particular point in time, the bringing together and the coordination. And it's not the case that this is the results that Euclid found. This is not the mathematics of Euclid. Nearly all the mathematics in the book is far older. And especially, you know, some of it, we know that it was discovered in the ancient Greek world or the Eastern Mediterranean. Alexandria, of course, is in Egypt. And that was the center of mathematical study. But a lot of it coming from ancient Babylon, coming out of different parts of Africa. But it is this really well-documented collection of the mathematical knowledge of a certain period. So from that point of view, it's this sort of great window into the past. And then you have the fact that up until the 19th century, it was actively used as not just a textbook, but the textbook for geometry. And it's still usable as a modern text. I'm teaching geometry at the University of Arkansas right now, and one of the textbooks is Euclid's Elements. And so it's quite usable as a textbook in a modern mathematics class. Now, part of that is because in the 19th century, when people started to really look at the foundational ideas of mathematics, how the logical structure of mathematics could be built and try to. So at that time, a lot of paradoxes were being dealt with, especially around calculus. People had found that calculus didn't work quite as well as everyone assumed. There were some issues with it. So the question was, how can we have faith in mathematics at all? And one of the ways that question was thought to be resolved was to go back to geometry and the way that Euclid's Elements sets up geometry. So it sets it up by creating a series of statements, of rules, and then those are all you're allowed to use. So you have some basic objects like points, lines, circles. And if you have two lines, there's some rules as to whether or not they intersect. And if they intersect, what can you say about that intersection? So you have this structure that you basically set up your system, and then you can start to do stuff within that system. But you can only do the things that you've either said that you can do or things that you have shown you can do within that system. So the first proposition is to take those rules and say, we can construct an equilateral triangle on a given line. So now, anytime I give you a line, you know that you can create an equilateral triangle. So this idea, which is sometimes called the axiomatic method, was one of the ways that mathematics went to solve the issue of how can we trust that mathematics is correct in some way. And so one of the reasons you can use it today in a modern math class when you couldn't use some other texts in the same way is because it played this important role in setting up new the way modern mathematics is done in some ways. The interesting thing is at that same time, Euclid as geometry was becoming less important. So the structure of Euclid was becoming more important, but at the same time, geometry was becoming a lot broader than the elements. And in particular, you have ideas of what are called non-Euclidean geometry. You can see the importance of Euclid even when it gets pushed aside. So non-Euclidean geometry is the geometry you need to have in order, for example, to deal with general relativity.
Joshua Youngblood with Special Collections. Will there be examples from the university collections included? I mean, physical examples that students can see from the university collection?
Yep. So one of the things that we've done over the last couple of years, as Dr. Harris has developed his history of math and his literature of math instruction in the Department of Math, and as we've partnered, but then also as we started thinking about what a class like this could end up being, Special Collections has grown its collections very intentionally. Something that we're very proud of in the university libraries is our ability to respond to, anticipate, and work with the needs of programs on campus. And so we add, whether it's an archival collection or it's a rare book or it's things that are being published now or electronic resources, of course, we're always trying to meet the research and learning needs of campus. For this class in particular, we've added several examples that students will be working with. And these are extremely rare and very interesting, fascinating books that students will actually be using to do research projects. Through the history of math instruction we've done, Edmund and I have had the chance to look at a 1607 edition of the elements that the library's had in its collections for decades, since the early 20th century. And it's great because it's this chunky, big textbook like brick of math that was published in 1607. And students have been able to use that for, well, if they knew it was here, they could request it themselves, just like anything from the university libraries. But to add to that, we recently acquired a 1537 early Latin edition of Euclid in the original binding, just like a textbook that you would have had to have special access to, say, a university in Basel, Switzerland, which is where it was published, in order to see this book. But this is, we've talked about the word reverence. This is a reverential object, if you look at it in that way. But it's also just a textbook, but it's a textbook from the 16th century. We've also added a very interesting publication of Euclid from 1847 by Oliver Byrne, which is beautiful and has meaning with it that really goes beyond just the study of geometry, because it used a four-color printing method.
Wow.
It's this gorgeous, gorgeous book, but also is a very fragile book because of paper technology in the 19th century and how paper would degrade. And there actually aren't that many examples of this book available in any library, much less in public university libraries. But we have one here at the University of Arkansas. And so students will be able to work with these rare texts, as well as supplementing that with an array of digital surrogates, digital collections available from other universities and other researchers, and then maybe taking some of those ideas and maybe even playing with them in the digital universe themselves. So taking images from our books and then seeing what they mean and seeing how they can transform them.
Edmund, I want to ask, because we're talking, you know, when you were talking about non-Euclidean and the first proposition and the fourth, and you can see that's wrong now, this is more on the two millennia since Euclid. I mean, we're going to give Euclid a kind of a break because it was 2,000 years ago and he might have been working with the best that he had at the time?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, as I say, that the picture of what mathematics could be then And we're not criticizing Euclid as an individual. We're criticizing the text, and criticizing not in the sense of trying to bring it down, trying to destroy it. I mean, it's something I absolutely adore and love. But I think, you know, that's something, as somebody who grew up in Britain, we, you know, learning about the history of the British Empire, to both be proudly British and deeply ashamed of the past and some of the aspects is something to bear in mind. And I think, as I was saying, with objects of reverence, it's sometimes declared that it's wrong to criticize them. Mm-hmm. And I think that is a deeply flawed idea. If something is robust and important enough to be revered, then it's also robust and important enough to be criticized and to be analyzed from multiple points of view.
I can't wait to hear about how the class went. Joshua, I can't help but think of somebody in the early 16th century getting that 1506 copy.
Wait, 1607, 1537.
Okay. They get this copy. And then they find out that there's a revised edition, and they have to buy the new one, and they have to sell that textbook back.
Well, you know, we don't need to talk about publishers and publishers' profits, but the textbook industry, this whole other, we'll call it a sub-thread throughout the class. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned that, though, because, for instance, the 1537, there is an earlier Greek from 1533. We're talking about printed books. So 1537, there's a 1533. There's one from the 1480s, which is a really, really important text. But even then, you know, every time you have a revised edition today, it's like, oh, there's a new preface, or somebody else wrote an introduction, or, oh, there's more critical notes in it. But you can see that in the real object. So if you look at the 1537 versus the 1607, which, again, students are going to be able to look at both of those. There's the format of it. The 1537 is a big folio book that's in this leather-bound thing. And the 1607 is a compact brick, which you could imagine someone actually putting in their, maybe not a JanSport, but, you know, whatever satchel they have to carry around with them. But even in the books themselves, in the text, how the text is presented, there are important differences. So in the 1537, one of the really fascinating things about that book for me, and I can't wait to talk to students about this, is it has an introduction by Philip Melanchthon in it, who is a humanist thinker. So it's published in Basel, Switzerland, at a time of a great exchange of ideas and also rapidly changing religious and political environments. And the introduction to that book is from this humanist leader and humanist thinker who also happened to be interested in math. But he puts a preface to this book so that you can understand Euclid, and that's very particular to this early 16th century mindset. And then also in that edition is Proclus, a Greek thinker, is in there too. So you have both these people in that edition, and that's very different than the 1607 one. What's fascinating is how the diagrams and how the block printing, because each one of these editions we're talking about has different illustrations. Those had to be handmade. And sometimes, just like the text itself, it's based on earlier versions. And sometimes it's changed or it's transitioned. And you could see the same diagram in a 1607 or even an edition of Euclid from the 19th century, from the 1800s. They'll have the exact same shape of intersecting lines or ways to illustrate a proof that you would have seen drawn in a manuscript from 1100 or 1200. And that's a fascinating thing to see how this text is both a baseline of learning and referred to, but then also how it's adapted continually over time.
Edmund Harris is an assistant professor in the math department at the University of Arkansas. And Joshua Youngblood is the head of instruction and outreach in special collections in the University of Arkansas Library Rare Books Collection. We talked with both of them recently by Zoom. There is more, so much more, to hear about this topic, and you have a chance to hear more with both of the men delivering a free virtual lecture preview of the course at 5:15 tomorrow evening. You can learn more about the lecture and how to register for the free event at the University of Arkansas Honors College website or their social media pages. The course will be available for students in the U of A Honors College next spring.
The 5th Annual International Festival at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks is Sunday, September 19th from 2 to 6 p.m. This free event is a part of Welcoming Week and includes traditional dance performances from around the world and ethnic food available for purchase. Blankets and lawn chairs welcome. RSVP at bgozarks.org.
Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, we continue our survey of the first 150 years of the University of Arkansas with Charlie Allison, who is the executive editor of University Relations at the U of A. He'll tell us about the building of Old Main, the first and still oldest building on the University of Arkansas campus. That and so much more on tomorrow's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on KUAF 91.3. Also available wherever you are through the KUAF app and KUAF.com, and whenever you are if you subscribe to our free podcast edition of the Ozarks at Large Daily Show. During this year's fall on-air fundraiser, which is a couple of weeks away, KUAF will not be offering coffee mugs, CDs, or T-shirts as thank you gifts for your support. Instead, this autumn, we're partnering with Penguin Ed's Barbecue to provide meals to ICU and emergency room workers in hospitals across our listening area. Every afternoon of our on-air fundraiser from 3 to 7 and all day Saturday on September 25th, we're asking you to support the public radio programming you rely on every day. And when we receive 30 gifts of $30 or more, we'll be able to provide an area hospital with a Penguin Ed's gift card that will feed 50 nurses, doctors, administrators, janitorial staff, and more. The on-air portion of our fundraiser will begin Friday, September 24th, and it ends Thursday, September 30th. We will take a break in the middle for Sunday, September 26th. We hope to provide an opportunity for listeners to support all the news, music, entertainment, connection, and more that they get from KUAF, and to also support the hardworking individuals who have been on the front line of the pandemic for more than a year and a half.
One of public radio's most iconic programs is Fresh Air with Terry Gross. Terry has conducted insightful and in-depth interviews with guests ranging from heads of state to entertainment figures for more than 45 years. KUAF has been able to bring you Fresh Air for decades because of the support of our listeners. Fresh Air will cost KUAF more than $21,000 this year, and thousands of KUAF listeners help us pay for it. A gift of $5 a month would pay for one day of Fresh Air this year. It takes a community to support a program like this, and your support now will keep the excellent and inspiring interviews coming for years to come. Make a difference to your public radio station. Give at supportkuaf.com, and thank you.
This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Johnson. KUAF is a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. And you can listen to us anytime, anywhere through KUAF.com or that updated free KUAF app that's available for iPhones and iPads. Timothy Dennis produced today's show. Contributors today included Jacqueline Froelich, who also contributed news and information about distracted driving patrols in the state of Arkansas. Plus, Matthew Moore also contributed today. Our weekly conversations between John Brummett, a political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, and Roby Brock with our partner Talk Business and Politics, part of our continuing partnership with Talk Business and Politics. You can follow Arkansas Business and Politics every day at talkbusiness.net. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Daryl is often performing weekday afternoons around 4 o'clock our time. If you go to his Facebook or Instagram pages, you can find out more about his music wherever you look for music online. We are going to be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 for a brand new Wednesday edition of Ozarks at Large. And a reminder that you can always find past editions of our show, including individual stories, interviews, and features at ozarksatlarge.com. Each of those individual stories, interviews, and features comes with a little link that allows you to share them through email or social media. And if you'd like us to send those links to you, make it just one step easier, we can do that. There is the KUAF Ozarks at Large daily email newsletter. It's free. It comes to you once a day, Monday through Friday in the afternoon, and it lists important news and information that you should know, as well as what was on that day's Ozarks at Large, and provides those links so you can share a story that you think someone else might think is important. Finally, if you think it's important that some of you know have access to a COVID-19 vaccination, we have information about vaccinations near you and near them. Just go to KUAF.com, look at the top of the page for the tab that says Find a COVID-19 vaccination near you. Click on that, and there's information. From the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums.